Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, we continue the discussion started in our last episode with Philip Cunliffe on the subject of humanitarian intervention, but this time with Dan Kovalik, a labor and human rights attorney and the author of the new book, No More War: How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interests. In this book, Dan argues that U.S. claims of humanitarianism when intervening in other countries and engaging in wars abroad is more or less an Orwellian lie. That the truth is, the U.S. engages in these interventions and wars to benefit itself. Surely a controversial claim for some, and yet this is Parallax Views, and we're all about providing a different viewpoint. So with that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Dan Kovalik, author of No More War: How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interests. Welcome to Parallax Views, Dan Kovalik, author of No More War: How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interests. How are you doing today, Dan? And by the way, I always have to mention this when I have a guest on from Pittsburgh. Welcome to the show. Greetings, because we're in Pittsburgh here too. So.
Oh, I didn't even know that. Well, good to see you then.
So, Dan, maybe for my listeners that are unfamiliar, this is not your first book. What have you been writing about in the past, and how does it all tie together with this new book, No More War?
Well, so far I've written five books, and they all deal with U.S. foreign policy. They're all very critical of U.S. foreign policy. They start from the premise that U.S. wars are fought for treasure and for geopolitical gain and are not done to advance democracy or human rights, as the U.S. almost invariably claims. Most of the books up to the most recent one have been focusing on particular countries. I have one, about Venezuela, another about Iran, another about Russia. This one is a more of a bird's eye view of U.S. foreign policy, mostly since World War II, and how the U.S. has undermined international law, really from the beginning of the U.N. Charter, to carry out multiple wars up to and through the present time.
Now, one thing I want to get out of the way really quickly here is I like how you use the word humanitarian in quotes, because I think – the idea of humanitarianism isn't necessarily a bad idea, right? But the way it's invoked, I don't think what's going on is actually humanitarian.
Yeah, exactly. it is a trick, really. You know, almost every war is fought on some with some grand moral pretext, right? I mean, even Hitler claimed to invade the Sudetenland to protect ethnic Germans, right? Everyone claims they're doing something for good purposes, even if they're not. The humanitarian intervention canard has been certainly used often throughout the years, but it's really since the collapse of the Soviet Union that it's become this freestanding doctrine to justify U.S. unilateral action throughout the world. And it's, of course, the Democrats tend to use it more explicitly than the Republicans. Though, again, the Republicans themselves will justify all the military adventures we engage in based on, again, some grand moral crusade. But it's really humanitarian intervention is really a liberal invention, really, to justify foreign invasions.
Where does this idea of humanitarian intervention initially arise from?
Well, again, in its modern form, it comes out of the attempt by the U.S., and in this case, the Clinton administration, to come up with a justification for continuing to spend an ungodly amount of money on the military and to continue to engage in these foreign interventions in the absence of the great menace, the evil empire, the Soviet Union, which collapsed in 1991. And so the first time humanitarian intervention, as that term is currently used, was tried out was in the former Yugoslavia in 1999 by the Clinton administration. This was the first time they explicitly used the notion of humanitarian intervention and R2P, the responsibility to protect, to justify a bombing, in this case, a European country. And as many know, contrary to the very clear requirements of the UN Charter, Clinton did not get UN authorization, did not get Security Council authorization for this attack. He couldn't have because Russia would never had agreed with it. So he used humanitarian intervention as a pretext for engaging what would otherwise and really is an unlawful war of aggression in the former Yugoslavia. And as I talk about my book, and I, you know, there's others who frankly talked about it better, and I cite people like Noam Chomsky, people like Michael Parente. They've explained it even better that, first of all, the worst atrocities that were committed by the Serbs happened after and really as a result of the NATO bombing of Serbia, okay? That this bombing didn't stop atrocities. They actually accelerated them as the Serbs panicked as a result of the bombing. Number one. Number two, of course, NATO bombed Serbia for 79 days and focused a lot on attacking civilians and civilian infrastructure, excuse me, in violation of international humanitarian law. So not only did the NATO bombings accelerate the atrocities by the Serbs, but of course, the bombings themselves constituted war crimes. And the third issue really I should have put first in no particular order. The third issue was that there were two moments in time when there was a very real chance of a peace deal in between the former Yugoslav republics. And in both occasions, the U.S. by the admission of people who were in the room, put a monkey wrench into those peace deals and prevented those deals from being signed. Deals which could have saved many, many lives because the war would have ended. And why did the U.S. do this? Because the U.S. wanted a war in Yugoslavia, right? It was a war looking for a pretext, which is true of almost all wars the U.S. gets involved in, right? The U.S. wants to invade somewhere and then invents a pretext to do it. And that was the case here. The U.S. had a number of reasons for wanting to attack the former Yugoslavia. One was to permanently break up the last socialist country in Eastern Europe and to open up that region for imperial exploitation, which it did. But all, again, under this pretext of humanitarianism. And that canard has been used a number of times since, I think most famously and recently in Libya by the Obama administration.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which was formed all the way back in 1949 to sort of push back against the perceived threat of the Soviet Union. In a way, it's weird to me that there's still an organization like NATO after the Cold War. What purpose does NATO serve now? And also, if you could, maybe you could comment on a lot of people in 2016 really started saying criticism of NATO is unacceptable. I had Democrats telling me that, and I was saying, you know, I don't like Donald Trump, and I don't actually think Donald Trump is necessarily even anti-NATO. It just seems like he's more upset that, oh, these other countries in it aren't paying their fair share. But now it's gotten to the point where I'm being told you can't even criticize NATO.
Well, yeah, and part of that is because of the way our two-party system works and the bipartisan nature of our politics, essentially, and particularly in the Trump era, where essentially those on the ostensible left or who are left of center believe that they have to oppose anything Trump does or says because he's doing or saying it, right? And so because Trump has expressed some skepticism about NATO and about continued hostilities with Russia, that is now seen as a bad thing to do. And so the liberals have rallied around NATO, as you say, and around the idea that we have to confront Russia. So a very recent example of this, of course, is that Trump wanted to get 9,000 troops out of Germany, which I believe there's a total of 35,000 still there, which is quite incredible, right? You want to take 9,000 and bring them home. Seems reasonable to most of us. Well, again, the liberal press, the liberal politicians said, oh, you can't do that. You're going to leave Germany open to Russian aggression. Of course, Germany's position was we don't see Russia as a threat, right? But they pushed that line. And they actually worked with Liz Cheney to prevent those troops from being brought home and also to prevent Trump from taking troops out of Afghanistan. Again, based on this claim, which I think has been debunked, that Russia was somehow – it was paying bounties to the Taliban to kill American soldiers.
I believe that claim was based on an anonymous source, too, that we really can't, you know, vet.
Oh, yeah. An anonymous intelligence source, you know, who then there get, you know, of course, gets reported on the New York Times. Oh, how many times have we been fooled by anonymous intelligence sources, right? But it was very effective in again, preventing us from drawing down in Afghanistan. again, was Trump right to want to draw down in Afghanistan? I believe he is, for whatever reasons he wants to do it. But it was the Democrats who prevented that from happening. So we do have this bizarre situation where not only Democratic leadership, but even the rank and file, who tend to fall in behind the leadership, have decided that drawing down troops abroad is bad because that's what Trump wants to do. It's completely irrational. I mean, I think those of us who have principles, anti-war principles, you know, we could say, okay, you know, a broken clock is right twice a day. Trump is a nut. He's a bad guy, but he's right on these couple issues. So, you know, great. And maybe even because he has some of these inclinations to back off on eternal war. He said this recently, that we got to stop our endless wars, right? Maybe we could even get him to draw down troops more in other countries, right? Instead, again, the liberal establishment has done just the opposite. And to me, that's a huge lost opportunity. And if you read my book, my most recent book in particular, I would say I'm tougher on the Democrats than I even am on the Republicans on these types of issues, because I think people have been fooled somehow that the Democrats are like these peaceniks and the Republicans are hawks, when frankly, both parties are hawkish. And in reality, there's times when the Democrats are even more hawkish than the Republicans. For example, if I can give you another example, you have John Bolton, who's a famous warmonger, right, who's even too much of a warmonger for Trump, right, so that he ends up getting forced out, resigning as national security advisor. So John Bolton writes a tell-all book against Trump. And so because, again, we all hate Trump, people were like, hey, John Bolton, you're our hero now. And then when John Bolton said, hey, in his book, guess what? If Trump gets another term, he's going to meet with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Instead, again, of a lot of us on the left saying, great, he should. You have people like Joe Biden coming out and saying he should never meet with Maduro. He's a dictator and all that. So, again, the liberals end up being the more hawkish on these issues. And I just think it's important to see through that. I will almost definitely vote for Biden for president. Okay. Many of us will, not because we love Biden. I mean, he's basically a walking corpse at this point, right? But most of us think that he'd be better than Trump. But at the same time, we have to be willing to push a Biden to stop these wars, right? We should have pushed Obama to do that. Obama got free, you know, he got utterly free rein from the liberals. He got it during his administration. He gets it now. He's beyond criticism. Even though his invasion of Libya was, by his own admission, or at least he admits that the fallout from Libya was a disaster, right? But again, because he's our guy, we don't criticize him for those things. So in that sense, I'd like to think my book is timely in the sense that we will probably end up with a Biden presidency and therefore a likely continuation of this humanitarian interventionism. And ideologically, we have to be prepared for that, be prepared to reject it.
Real quick, that first part of my question with NATO, as I was sort of alluding to, it seems odd that NATO still exists in this post-Soviet era. I mean, to me, I look at NATO and I think to myself, this is really an arm of empire. What yes. other function does it really serve? I mean, am I getting it right there?
Well, it's like seeing all those forts along the western United States that we used to fight against Native Americans that we just keep around. Like, why?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I agree. I think, And again, I think Clinton's foray into Yugoslavia, which was a NATO action, right, as was the attack on Libya, a NATO action. I think these were partly an intention to keep NATO going in the absence of what you're saying, in the absence of the obvious raison d'etre for them. So I do think that this is essentially the armed wing of the West, and in particularly the United States, that can be pulled out anytime, anywhere to carry out imperial aggression. You may know that Colombia, South America, is now an auxiliary member of NATO. So now they've even expanded it beyond Europe. And again, which really shows that they want it to have a meaning beyond that it had during the Cold War. With that said, I think that people should be concerned, though, that there are new hostilities that are being stoked with Russia and China, and that NATO could be used against, you know, Russia and or China. So in a way, sadly, the Cold War, which should have ended with the collapse of the Soviet Union, in some ways it continues to this day. We saw that with the Russiagate stuff. We see that with the claims of the Russian bounties in Afghanistan. And so that raison d'etre may in fact still be there. That is, there still may be a desire to have that instrument, that Cold War instrument, to fight the new Cold War.
Now, in regards to the sort of long, deep history of interventionism, you take this all the way back to King Leopold, and I think I may have listeners that, I mean, just from my experience, I didn't learn about King Leopold that much in high school. So who was King Leopold, and how do you tie him into all of this?
Yeah, well, he's an interesting figure. First of all, maybe people are learning a little because they're seeing statues of him being taken down in Belgium. King Leopold in the late 19th century decided to personally, under his own name, take over the Congo in Africa, a huge country. If you look at it at the map, it's a huge country geographically, and it also is maybe the most resource-rich country on Earth. And he wanted it for two main things: rubber, the burgeoning rubber industry, which was continued to grow into the 20th century with the, you know, the invention of the automobile, and the ivory trade. And so what King Leopold did to gain international support for his conquest of Congo was to send emissaries around the world, including to the U.S., and convince heads of state and other important people that he was going into Congo to protect the human rights of the Congolese. He claimed in particular to protect them from the Arab slave trade, which did exist. And he convinced people of this. They even had societies that gave him money, you know, to help out the Congolese. In fact, he did nothing of the sort. He enslaved the Congolese. He brutalized the Congolese to carry out, again, the rubber trade, to build a railroad infrastructure to allow him to ship rubber and ivory from the inland to the coasts. And in the process, it's pretty well accepted that he killed 10 million people in Congo.
Yeah, the 10 million body count, I've heard a lot, and it's, you know, it's mind-boggling to even consider that.
Yeah, it's an amazing number. Meanwhile, in addition to killing people, if workers were non-compliant, he would often have their hands cut off. Women and children were brutalized, raped. I mean, his reign over Congo was brutal. But he did it explicitly in the name of humanitarianism and human rights. And so I think, at least as far as I can tell, this is the one of the first, maybe crudest examples of what becomes humanitarian interventionism. And what's interesting is that there were intellectuals in the day, some honest intellectuals, unlike today, there's not so many, who caught on to what was happening there. One was a guy named Mark Twain, who helped form the Anti-Imperialist League. And he and others put pressure on the world community to take Belgium or to take Congo away from King Leopold, which is a good part of this story, certainly. The problem is that ultimately it was given then to Belgium as a state. They weren't much better there. And the track record of the West in Congo since that time has been, you know, pretty brutal. Yeah.
It's interesting, too. You mention an author in relation to this, and I'm not going to try to pronounce his name because I'll botch it, but he wrote a book called King Leopold's Ghost, and I think you sort of diverge from him a little bit with regards to how he views interventionism.
Yeah, so first of all, his description of King Leopold's hold over Congo, what he did there, is wonderful. And I urge everyone to read the book. I think he literally wrote the book on this issue. But I think the conclusions he draws at the end, I disagree with. I mean, in the end, he still falls back on the position that the West and Western human rights groups are the people who will save, you know, countries like Congo from exploitation. Of course, you know, ignoring the fact that Belgium itself was a Western country that was doing this, that the U.S. was the first country to recognize King Leopold's hold over Congo, and really ignoring the fact that the U.S., since 1996, has continued to support invasions of Congo, with the result being the death of over 6 million Congolese. That's in addition to the 10 million that Leopold killed. You know, so the West is no savior to these people.
It's interesting, not to interrupt you, but I was going to say, sure. I think the way the West looks at it is, or the way that these things are sort of justified is this idea of, oh, it's the white man's burden. We have to save these people, that sort of manifest destiny idea. It's not based on anti-colonialism or anti-colonial struggle.
No, in fact, the West, what happened after World War II in particular, was that after World War II, you had the beginning of a massive anti-colonial struggle throughout the Third World. And the West and the U.S. leading the charge prevented or tried to prevent them from succeeding.
The massacres in Indonesia come to mind immediately in 65 and 66. I mean, we participated in that. It was the Third World Movement, and we just destroyed it.
Absolutely. The killing of Patrice Lumumba in Congo, the first democratically elected Prime Minister of Congo, which was carried out by the U.S. and Belgium, which has set that country back many, many decades. The war in Vietnam, the war in Korea, all these were pro-colonial wars by the West, led by the United States. The irony is that the U.S., which of course celebrates every July 4th, its shedding of its colonial master, England, did everything in its power to stop colonies from being liberated in the 20th century. And in fact, it was the Soviet Union that tended to support those struggles. And so the U.S. would often, of course, claim that it was fighting communism or the Soviet Union. In fact, what it was doing is trying to prop up colonialism. And that's a shameful part of U.S. history that most people don't understand.
Would it be possible to dig down into that with regards to South Africa? Because that's one of the most fascinating parts of your book. I mean, because there's this whole revisionist history saying, oh, we always supported ending apartheid. But as you point out, you know, Nelson Mandela was thankful to the Soviets and to Cuba, not necessarily right. The U.S.
No, not at all. Right, and for good reason. So the U.S., first of all, it supported the most retrograde, you know, regimes in Africa, including apartheid South Africa. And by the way, apartheid South Africa, in large measure, the system of apartheid there was based on the U.S.'s Jim Crow system. So, you know, the U.S. was even an inspiration for apartheid. And for many years at the U.N., there would be U.N. resolutions denouncing apartheid. And the U.S. and Israel would invariably veto those resolutions. The U.S. tacitly at least supported apartheid almost to the end. And certainly it supported South Africa in its hold over Namibia and in its war against the newly independent state of Angola. The only reason that South Africa was dislodged from Namibia and Angola, they were dislodged militarily by Cuban troops being backed by the Soviet Union. And the victory of Cuba over the South African army, this was the only time the South African military had ever been defeated. As Nelson Mandela himself says, this gave incredible inspiration to the ANC, to the people in South Africa fighting apartheid. And in fact, the massive uprisings in Cape Town happened after this routing of South Africa by the Cubans. At the same time, it demoralized the South African military and government. And so again, Mandela ends up crediting Cuba hugely for the end of apartheid. He believes that they played a significant role in this. Also by the way, training ANC guerrilla fighters, right, for many years. In fact, I have a friend in Pittsburgh whose brother, they're from England originally, moved to South Africa. His brother fought with the ANC. He was trained in Cuba and Moscow. This was very typical, right? This is who was supporting the armed struggle in South Africa and in the frontline states, Namibia, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, etc. So we have this impression because we'll see, you know, after Mandela's released from prison, then runs for president and becomes president, you know, Clinton – meets with Mandela, embraces him, and all of a sudden, oh, he's our guy. He's always been our guy. But it's not true. In fact, he remained on the U.S. terrorist list till 2008. Moreover, it was the CIA, the U.S. CIA, who initially in 1962 helped get him arrested in South Africa, leading to his decades-long imprisonment on Robben Island. You know, Mandela was seen as enemy number one in the world. They did not want him to succeed. Again, it was the Cubans in the Soviet Union and also Muammar Gaddafi in Libya who really supported that struggle. And again, most people have a totally different view of this. They really have the opposite view of what happened. Somehow they think the U.S. helped liberate South Africa, which is just a joke.
Well, that brings me around to a character in your book by the name of Samantha Power, who I assume – it seems like she has a very different view than your view. Who is Samantha Power, and why is she so central to your book? Why do you feel the need to address her?
Well, I think she is – first of all, I think she, to me at least, and to many who hold my view and to many who don't, she is kind of the face of humanitarian interventionism. She – first of all, wrote this Pulitzer Prize-winning book called A Problem from Hell, which decried genocide in the world. But the strange part about this book was that it never talked about Western genocide. It was all about those other people committing genocide.
Western exceptionalism at its finest.
Exactly. And her critique of the West in the book wasn't that it committed genocide, but that many times it didn't do enough to prevent those people from carrying out genocide. So the whole thrust of her book is the U.S. and the West have to engage more actively, including militarily around the world, to stop genocide. Now, of course, this begs the question or ignores the issue of the fact that many of the U.S.'s and the West's forays abroad have resulted in genocide, right? And that where Samantha Power and I think, really disagree is I think if you care about human rights and genocide, the best thing you can do as an American is stop our country from going to war. She takes the opposite view, that we have to go to war to prevent genocide. And then, in addition to being an academic, she had her chance in the Obama administration to actually carry out her views. So she became ambassador to the United Nations for the United States. And in this role, she and Hillary Clinton and Susan Rice played an instrumental role in convincing Obama to go along with a NATO attack on Libya. And they did so, of course, under the pretext of human rights and preventing genocide. So here, Samantha Power, she was an academic. Now she gets her chance to put her ideas into practice. And what happens? First of all, the U.S. Lies about what was happening in Libya. There were three key lies upon which that war was based. One, that Gaddafi was giving Viagra to his troops to carry out mass rapes. This was utterly debunked later by Amnesty International. The second claim is that Gaddafi was poised to carry out genocide in Benghazi. That ends up to be debunked. Also, if you look at internal emails that I discuss in my book, the Clinton team was very open in their internal emails that by the time NATO started bombing Libya, Benghazi was safe, okay, and in fact was under opposition control. But the third most nefarious lie, which ends up leading to genocide, actually, was that Gaddafi was using black mercenaries from sub-Saharan Africa to carry out his war in Libya. Why was this the most nefarious lie? Because what all ends up happening, first of all, again, this becomes debunked. The Amnesty International, while first supporting this narrative and therefore helping support the NATO invasion, later says this is not true, that in fact these mercenaries were nothing more than Africans who were guest workers in Libya. They were invited to work there. And in fact, the press was saying you could tell the black mercenaries by their yellow helmets. Yeah, because they were construction workers, not mercenaries, right? But what ends up happening, not only does this give a justification for the NATO invasion, which itself targets civilians, destroys entire cities, but it also leads to a genocide against sub-Saharan Africans living in Libya. The jihadists that the U.S. and NATO supported to overthrow Gaddafi end up depopulating entire towns of black Libyans, arresting people because they were black, killing people because they were black. Well, that's called genocide. So the irony of ironies is that Samantha Power, the great crusader against genocide, played a very significant part in the genocide that happens in Libya. It's an incredible irony of history. And I compare her in my book to King Leopold, which I'm sure some people will wince at. But the two are very similar because – now, I'm not going to – I don't believe she wanted a genocide to happen in Libya. But she was so blinded by her own ideology and so blind, frankly, to the other interests that were pushing other people in the Obama administration to push for this invasion and the other interests pushing other NATO countries into wanting this invasion, none of which had to do with human rights, that she plays a role in one of the great disasters, really, of this century so far. Libya is destroyed as a country. It was the most prosperous country in Africa at the time. It's now the least prosperous. It is being ruled, if ruled at all, by three warring factions.
I believe there's been explosions in, like, human trafficking in Libya
and
now.
Slavery.
Yeah.
And slavery. There are now slaves. And again, these are black people being sold on the streets of Libya.
And this is not necessarily to defend Gaddafi either, because you say that in the book. Gaddafi isn't, the perfect leader either, but...
Right. He's not. I mean, and he was brutal in his own ways. But there's a few things to be said for it. He certainly was helpful to people of sub-Saharan Africa, including, again, by supporting the ANC. But also, he built mosques throughout Africa. He invited guest workers to work in Libya. I mean, he was a real friend to Africa. And he also did create a lot of prosperity for the people of Libya. While he was not a saint, he also did some good things. But also, the other issue, and this goes deeper into this problem, I think, with humanitarian interventionism, and a guy I cite a lot in the book, Jean Bricmont, talks a lot about this in his book called Humanitarian Imperialism. All this assumes that history is static. Okay, and what I mean by that is, and what Bricmont means by this is, yes, Gaddafi used dictatorial means to build up the prosperity of Libya. This is true. At the same time, Gaddafi was moving towards democracy in his country, largely at the urging of his son, Saif Gaddafi, who was working with the International Democratic Institute, right, based in Washington, D.C., to try to build a constitutional democracy in Libya. And so, as Bricmont again talks about, the U.S. did not become a full democracy, if it even is yet, but that's another question, maybe for another day. But it is relevant, I think, to this discussion. Overnight, the U.S. had slavery, right, which we're now for the first time, frankly, kind of grappling with, right, that history. The U.S. committed genocide against Native Americans. The U.S. didn't allow women to vote. Right until the 20th century. There are many ways in which the U.S. did not live up to its ideals of democracy until a couple hundred years into its history, right? And yet the U.S. will justify an invasion of a country like Libya saying, oh, we're going to invade you. Why? Because you're not as democratic as we are. This assumes that countries cannot have their own path to development and democracy, right? there's no country in the world that has had a nice, clean path to democracy, right? And yet, this idea that Libya deserves to be invaded ignores not only our own history, ugly history of development, but says, oh, Libya, you have to do it differently. You have to be nicer about your development than we were, right? And I hope I explained that well. But Brickmont does that very well. You know, basically what's happened is, you know, the West has developed on the backs of the Third World, right? By looting the Third World, by enslaving people from the Third World. And now that the Third World wants to develop, they say, oh, you have to do it in a nice way after we've plundered you, right? After we've killed your independence leaders. And again, there's something, when you really think about it, unseemly about that. And frankly, I would say even racist about it. I mean, there is this problem with humanitarian interventionism. As, again, Brickmont notes, humanitarian interventionism is like the Mississippi River. It only runs north to south. You know, southern countries don't invade northern countries to promote humanitarianism. It's only the wealthy countries, mostly of the West, that do that, right? And one, there seems to be something incredibly unfair about this, but it also – the West justifies it with either a stated or a tacit belief that we're better than those people, that we have nothing to learn from these people, right? We're democratic and they're not. It's kind of this real old-time idea that justified what the U.S. did to develop in the first place, enslavement, killing native peoples. It's the view everyone else are savages who need to be ruled, and we're the good guys. When many, in most instances, when you look at these, you know, these wars, it's the complete opposite, truthfully.
In regards to that, I wanted to get into playing devil's advocate a bit here, because sure. I look at humanitarian interventionism. And I can see the critiques of it, how we talk about interventionism and how it's used to justify wars. But I'll look at an issue like what is happening in Gaza or in the West Bank, and I'll say, I don't think anything can be done unless an external force, you know, puts a stop to what is being done to the Gazans and the people in the West Bank. How would you respond to that? Because I know you cover it briefly in the book.
Yeah, and it's a great question. First of all, the UN Secretary General has talked about a possible need for some sort of military protection of the Palestinian people. I could probably be convinced to support that, but it would have to be done, first of all, through the Security Council of the UN. Under the UN charter, it's up to the Security Council to make that type of decision. And I think if that decision were made, it would be best if the people, the blue helmets who were sent there, and they should be blue helmets and not NATO troops, for example, should come from that region, not from outside it, because we've seen when the, you know, how Brazil, for example, Brazilian troops abuse the Haitian population, right, for years as UN troops. So first of all, they should come from the region. They should be UN troops, and there should be Security Council authorization for that. All of those things really distinguish that type of intervention from what the U.S. does. They generally don't try to get Security Council authorization for what they do. They try to do an end around of it. Of course, they send their own troops and Western troops to do the fighting, not UN troops. So I think that there may be a place for that. But as I also argue in my book, the chances of that ever happening are slim to none. Why? Because the U.S., which has veto power on the Security Council, I don't believe would ever support that.
Well, that's why it's interesting. I mentioned – I mean, we always talk about the Kurds and what's happening to the Kurds with the Turkish government, and that does actually really concern me. But we can get to that. No one ever talks about Palestine anymore. It seems like there's no talk of what is happening in the West Bank and Gaza, and I'm wondering, is this just because the U.S. doesn't see it as being in their interest to defend these people who are getting, you know, just obliterated?
Yes, I mean, that's absolutely the case. I mean, the view – look, what's happening now and what's been happening for certainly since 1948 to some extent, but which has been really accelerated in recent years, is that Israel has every intention to take over all of historic Palestine, including Gaza and the West Bank. They've been doing it by increments. But now they're speeding it up with this new annexation of the West Bank, with the starvation of Gaza. I mean, what's happening in Gaza is unforgivable. And the U.S. fully supports Israel in doing these things. The goal is for Israel to take over all of, again, former Palestine. And if that means wiping out all the Palestinians or pushing them all into Jordan – then so be it as far as the U.S. and Israel are concerned. And so, yeah, I think you see that reflected in a lack of news coverage about Palestine, about Gaza. If the U.S. media covered Gaza like they covered Syria, for example, we'd have a much different discussion of what's happening there. I feel, well, and a lot of people have said this, that the Palestinian people have been largely abandoned, even by the Gulf states like Saudi Arabia. The world has abandoned Palestine, and it's a shameful thing. The other country that's been abandoned, and we can't end our discussion without mentioning it, is Yemen.
I wanted to mention that, yeah, because I just had another guest on from antiwar.com who was saying, you know, we're supporting, you know, the Saudi just destruction of Yemen.
Yes, and literally the last figure I saw is that at least 5 million children have died in Yemen this year, due through starvation, due through disease, but all flowing from this war on Yemen that the U.S. has backed since the Obama administration. And that's another irony, you know, that has to be pointed out. Obama began supporting Saudi Arabia's attack on Yemen. Samantha Power, as ambassador to the UN, prevented a Security Council resolution which would have required an investigation into war crimes in Yemen. And so, again, these so-called humanitarian interventions started what is now becoming, and which was predicted to be even then, possibly the worst humanitarian crisis we've ever seen in modern times.
Well, it seems like there's a selectivity to it, right? Like we said with Gaza and the West Bank, it just abandoned, you know. Right. But when it comes to the Kurds and Turkey, we have to get involved. And I wanted you to comment on the issue with the Kurds and the Turkish government right now.
Yeah, well, this all goes back to what, you know, Chomsky and Edward Herman had been talking about for years, the late Edward Herman, sadly, that there are worthy victims in the world and unworthy victims, right? And the worthy victims in the U.S., the U.S. government and media view are those people who are being victimized by our enemies, right? Those are worthy victims. So we don't like China, right? China is our ostensible enemy. So we're very concerned about minorities being mistreated in China. Those are worthy victims. But when it's the U.S. or its client states committing abuses, those are unworthy victims. We don't care about them. So therefore, the Palestinians are considered unworthy victims. While, as you say, the Kurds in Syria are considered worthy victims. But it has to be pointed out that that can change, right? Because as Chomsky notes, under Bill Clinton, when Turkey was carrying out a genocidal war against Kurds in Turkey, because Turkey was the U.S.'s close ally, the Kurds at that time were considered unworthy victims, right? The U.S. continued to militarily support Turkey as they were killing Kurds. And so yeah, there's a very opportunistic view of all these things. But then when the U.S. is allied with the Kurds, like they are in Syria, all of a sudden they're worthy, right? And so I think that's the big critique of the current doctrine of humanitarian interventionism and really the whole human rights doctrine of the West, that it is selective. And it leads to really terrible results, again, as you see in Yemen, as you see in Palestine, as you see in Libya, you know, where terrible things have happened and those places just now tend to be ignored, right? When's the last time you heard about Libya in the news? We've wrecked the joint, left, and it's been forgotten, right?
There's just two more things I wanted to bring up if you have the time. The first was, okay, so we have gotten to this selective critique idea. Is there anything we can do to, say, help the Kurds in their struggle, aside from meddling in a way that will just make the problems worse? Well, what is your prescription?
Yeah, I mean, my prescription, again, that I'm very clear on, is that if you want to help, you know, promote human rights in the world, bring the troops home. You got to prevent U.S. intervention abroad. The U.S. is not out there helping promote human rights. The U.S. is destroying entire nations throughout the globe. If you care about human rights, build a peace movement, get on the streets like they did in, you know, during the Vietnam War, even during the war in Iraq in the run-up, we had some of the biggest protests ever against U.S. policy there. That's what we should do. That's our duty. It's not to police other countries. It's to prevent our country from continuing to go to war and to engage in wars of choice. And frankly, it will not only help those other countries, it will help us, because if we stop spending over $1 trillion a year on war and we spend that on our own people, you know, during a pandemic, for example, to protect people from disease and to give people unemployment supplements that are about to run out, to give people a guaranteed income, we'll be better off too. I mean, it's a win-win situation. But these issues are rarely linked in the public discourse, but they have to be.
I guess the final thing I wanted to mention is when we start talking about these things, the sort of criticism that comes up is that people will say, we're talking about genocide, and we said never again after the Holocaust. And if you are against or critical in any way of humanitarian interventionism, as we have sort of defined it, you're a genocide denier, is what the response is. How do you respond to that? Because I know you cover that in the book.
Yeah, no, I mean, what I would say is that there are genocides that happen. I don't see a case where the U.S. has ever stopped a genocide, except with the arguable exception of World War II, where it played a role supporting the Soviet Union and ending Hitler's reign of terror. But that instance aside, none of these interventions have prevented genocides. In fact, again, they have tended to promote them, right? So first of all, I don't see an instance of where humanitarian intervention has actually been humanitarian, not by the West anyway. There are a few examples I give in the book, arguable examples But they weren't carried out by the West.
You mean like Cuba?
I would say Cuba in Angola. The other examples that many people regard as true humanitarian interventions were Tanzania's foray into Uganda to stop Idi Amin, Vietnam's successful assault against Pol Pot that brought him out of power. Of course, the U.S. continued to support Pol Pot, the Khmer Rouge. And India's invasion of what became Bangladesh, which stopped a massive bloodletting there. So the instances that you can actually point to where this happened weren't done by the West at all. And so, look, if there's a genocide happening somewhere where troops could help stop that, I'm not going to say – I would always oppose that. But the question's going to be which troops, whose troops, and do you get Security Council authorization for that? Do you do it through legal means? And I would say yes. Again, so I fall back on my position that at least as I see history and current history and what's happening in the world today, to allow countries to peacefully develop, the U.S. simply needs to get out of them and stay out.
And I would just add to that, I think crucial to your argument, we can sort of see it in the title. I mean, I'm not sure any of us are opposed to the idea of humanitarian intervention if it wasn't – how do I put this? I mean, if it wasn't used as cover for economic and strategic interests, which is – that seems to be what's happening. It doesn't seem to actually be about humanitarianism.
Yeah, I mean you can dissect all these examples, and I've tried to in the book to show that none of these are humanitarian. Humanitarian interventionism is a lie. And if you start from that premise, then of course the result is that you oppose these interventions.
Casey, I didn't get give you much of a chance to speak. Anything you wanted to chip in here before we close out?
No, I think we've kept our guests long enough. This has been a wonderfully insightful interview. Thank you for coming on the show, Dan.
I really enjoyed it, and I'm glad to know you're from Pittsburgh, and maybe we'll get a chance to meet sometime.
I want to give you a chance, and I want to thank you as well for coming on Parallax Use. I want to give you a chance, though, to let my listeners know how they can get hold of the book or how they can keep up with your work.
Great. Actually, if I could just grab the book. So this is the book right here. You can get it pretty much wherever books are sold. Amazon, of course, but you can order it from Barnes & Noble. You can order it generally from any bookstore you want. If there's a bookstore you want to support, ask them to order the book. You can get it. So it's available pretty much where books are sold or at least can be ordered. You can find my more about my work, my ideas. I have a Facebook post, pretty active on Facebook and Twitter. My Twitter account is at Daniel M. Kabalik. I do some writing for Counterpunch. So those are places you can go to find my works. And if you go to my author page at Skyhorse, that's my publisher, you'll find all my books there and where you can get them.
And thank you again, Dan Kovalik, author of No More War, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you. This was a real pleasure. Real joy.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dan Kovalik, author of No More War, How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interests. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. And of course, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews.
producer's credits to Amelia, Martin, Mark, John, and Brace. Please consider joining them in getting a producer's credit for Parallax Views by joining the $10 tier on patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.